Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Joyce Carol Oates, the author most recently of Man Crazy, published by Dutton. I tend to talk to Joyce every 2 years or so, and in that interim, I like to gather the books that have come out during that time and talk about all of them. So we'll be also making excursions into We Were the Mulvaneys and the book of short stories, Will You Always Love Me, all of them published by Dutton. I wanted to begin with Man Crazy and to talk to you. This has the quality of a book about the torture of the innocent and seems to have affiliations with saints' lives, seems to be the kind of narration or confessions, religious conversion confessions. And I wondered, is this a kind of book in your imagination?
I had thought along those lines, Michael. And in fact, I shouldn't have been surprised that you said that, but I'm sitting here amazed. Yes, I had thought of the kind of evisceration of the self that one experiences in certain mystic states. And of course, in this particular instance, the young woman has experiences of extreme masochism. And she really becomes obliterated in herself, and then she's born again, in a sense. She's drawn back to life by this rhapsodic vision and memory of her mother, who sort of calls her back to life. It's the father figure or the principle of the masculine that has almost destroyed her, but it's the mother figure who calls her back to life. To me, writing the novel was an experiment in language. I thought perhaps I was working with the very poetry of female masochism. It's a kind of unspeakable radiance, a taboo subject that can scarcely be talked about, except I think by way of language, the language of fiction and of poetry.
When you say that, what was it like? Because, you know, going over the arc of these three books, this is the oddest span of voices that I've heard in your fiction, the widest range. The Mulvaneys is a kind of upper-middle-class language full of the reporter-narrator's ability to record and report elaborate detail, whereas Ingrid in Man Crazy is someone who takes in detail and transmutes it to something else, an internal order, and the voices are so wildly different, it seems to me.
Well, that's true. I think the vision of self-abnegation holds the novels together. Marianne is also a kind of eviscerated person by taking into and unto herself the sins of others. She obliterates herself, and so too with Ingrid. It's something that really appeals to me very much. I don't know why. I think there's a masochistic or a strain of the desire to punish oneself in the writer or in the artistic personality generally. I don't understand it. As if we're all doing penance.
There's a moment in Man Crazy. It was almost unearthly because it's almost an interpenetrative moment. Ingrid's father has come to see her through the schoolyard, the gate of the schoolyard, and I remembered moments of the returned father appearing in exactly that spot in, I believe, Wonderland and Do With Me What You Will.
You remember that? That's amazing. Yes, that's so true.
And there even seems to be almost a narrative gap because it's almost as if the writing has gone there the way the planchette of a Ouija board would, and almost as if it's shaking its head. The narrator says, but he couldn't see me there. It's almost a decision not to undergo this rabbit's hole effect of the child scrambling underneath the schoolyard gate to be taken into the world of the father, a decision that this kidnapping will not occur at this moment, that it will involve a different man and a different moment. But the book seems to...
to move toward that?
Move toward, yes.
Well, that's amazing. I think I probably wrote the scene before I remembered or realized that. I do have an image, and my novels tend to be predicated upon dominant images, especially man-crazy, that are haunting to me and mesmerizing, and then they rise to a level of the verbal, and then I tell the story. But basically, I'm haunted by these somewhat musical and rhapsodic images. So I think of a fence, a wire mesh fence, and I think of a child on one side of that fence, and probably it is a little girl, and this child may be myself. And I think of this shadowy figure approaching the fence, its or his features indistinct, but certainly it is a man, a father figure on the other side of the fence. And is he coming to liberate me, or is he coming to abduct me? Is he coming to make me complete, to give me love, or is he coming to destroy me, or is it in some way all the same thing? This is the way a writer works on a level that's almost inarticulate.
Mm-hmm. It used to be for you completely inarticulate. In fact, I've never heard you have so much access to it. Has something changed?
Well, I'm not sure. When you pointed that out, Michael, I could see the parallels, but I had not considered them until this minute.
It's a very interesting thing because, you know, someone once told me he'd spoken to your editor, William Abrams, who had said Joyce Carol Oates has the closest relation to the unconscious of any writer he had ever met. And I've sort of gotten used, when we're talking, to the idea that only certain parts of the process are available or even desirable to you.
Well, I'm sure that's true. And talking about writing or talking about any kind of creativity is very difficult. I think we can talk about manuscripts in editorial terms much more easily than we can talk about the genesis of those manuscripts.
Now, this story appeared as a short story, and when it won an award, the short story was called Ghost Girls. You mentioned that this came closest to the constellation of you and your parents, the flyer, the mother, the father, the daughter, but that everything was otherwise not autobiographical. And it's as if I've sensed that writing particular projects are about completing otherwise unlived possibilities.
Yes, I would say that's true. Also, it's based in a world that I remember, a region of my own life in upstate New York. The little girls and the older girls who were my friends, who were not so fortunate as I was, who did not escape that world, but who in fact married men rather like their fathers. In some cases, their fathers had been abusing and alcoholic and violent fathers, so they married men like the fathers. They've stayed in that world while I have escaped that world and moved on to another kind of life. But when I think back to those girls, I feel like a sister to them, and I want to complete them somehow in prose and tell their stories. So it's as if I were conjoined with them.
In another note, one to the story, I believe, Goose Girl, you say that you're drawn to certain figures who, you describe them, are not likely to be able to see themselves as others see them, which fascinates me because this seems to me to be the ultimate condition of Ingrid in Man Crazy.
That's right. These people would be seen from an objective point of view as very extreme, in some cases disliked, abnormal. The masochist, the young woman who doesn't flee a victimizing man but seeks him out in a sense to be his victim. It's a taboo subject. But feminists don't like to talk about these subjects that present women as so incomplete and so yearning.
Well, it's not only that. I was talking to a bookseller who was trying to explain to me what it was that took a writer out of the dread mid-list. She'd been thinking about this for a good long time, and she said it's always when a writer who readers have been resisting because of the passivity of the characters comes up with an active, forthright, take the future by the scruff of the neck type character, and at this point the readers are willing to come along. And that fascinated me because I think it's true that the passive, or what you're calling the masochistic level, is so frightening and feels so unwilled. Mm. I think that books that involve, in any case, reading a certain amount of hypnosis and passivity on the part of the reader, that if that submissiveness is then mirrored in the character, I think for readers the experience becomes more and more frightening.
That's very interesting. And possibly in bestsellers, the degree of autonomy of the protagonist is enhanced or, or exaggerated. So this person has a hyper sense of self-determination.
In the Book of Stories, too, there's a condition described in a story called Is Laughter Infectious? That inhabits man crazy as well. It's a laughter that contains no pleasure, is only, you know, mirth at the unpleasant unhappiness of others. And in this particular case, it's Ingrid who has been so worn down. She's been given a poetry prize, perhaps out of pity by her teacher. We don't know that. But she feels so inadequate that she goes to the library to choose another poem, and even thinks that a line in her poem that she found in a Robert Frost poem has been singled out, and she's being asked to read in order to be humiliated. Humiliation seems like the sine qua non of the situation. She's seeking it no matter what else might occur. And then the laughter that she hears and that she can't quite account for. She doesn't know which part of her ordeal was funny or what part of her ordeal deserved compassion. And it seems to me to be very much a Joyce Carol Oates state, where the laughter is not going to come in any reassuring way. This is not the sharing of a joke.
That's right. Well, in the story, Is Laughter Contagious? I was imagining a kind of experiment in which the world was suddenly denuded of the possibility of empathy and sympathy. And rather than helping someone who has spilled some possessions onto the floor, people just stood and laughed. Or seeing someone who is slightly deformed or disfigured, instead of feeling compassion or sympathy or pity, people objectify themselves and laugh at this person. I wanted to experiment with the idea of a world order in which we suddenly lack that ability to identify with one another, which I think makes us human. But there are societies in stages of breakdown in which I think the ability to sympathize with others no longer obtains. Then in Ingrid's story, she is so crippled with self-doubt, like many adolescents. She's a sort of parody or extension of the way we all might feel about our inadequacies. And many young girls feel so inadequate. They feel that they're ugly, they're too fat. In fact, they may be anorexic. They feel that they can't do the work. Some of my young women students, even at Princeton, have this sense that they're going to fail. Oh, it's no good. Oh, I can't do it. And they really are lacerating themselves. And Ingrid is in that mode.
This is Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and I'm talking to Joyce Carol Oates, particularly about her most recent book, Man Crazy. Now, there is a distinct breaking point in this book where what had been possibly even a Thornton Wilderish halo brought around the family unit, the father who flies and the romantic nature of that and the quality of certain American seasons and of rivers and bridges over them. There's a certain almost calendar art quality to the opening of the novel, a semi-parody that returns at the end. Not entire parody, but just an awareness that this is not likely to last and therefore must be looked at as a bit comic or cruelly comic. But the book seems to bring more degradation to Ingrid than I've witnessed in even many of your most disturbed characters. She is gnawed at by bugs and beetles and gnats and chits and mosquitoes, and almost as if to identify her from early on with what she literally becomes, a living corpse, by the end of the book. She's infested.
And her skin is inflamed. She picks at her own skin.
And there's, as well, you know, she drifts toward a satanic cult, and even once they've expelled her, she hears them calling her, as she will later hear her mother calling her. And she returns. She returns for more, being scarred with razor blades, a cross dug into her chest. And I thought of something that you said again about the Goose Girl. You say about the woman there that she could have been reported compassionately, but the compassion was not interesting in that case. And it feels almost as if the writer writing Ingrid has to subtract herself, that there's an abnegation on the part of the writer preventing the usual plea for pity, a kind of editorial mm-hmm. intercession, a Dickensian, you know, cry mm-hmm. for the babe quality that seems to be, how to put it, the dominant experience for this reader is of the absence, the considered intentional absence of the compassionate hand of the writer. Why is that desirable?
I wasn't really intending that, probably. I didn't want Ingrid to seem in any way self-pitying. She never complains, you know. She feels that the punishment she's experiencing is deserved. Basically, I think there are some of us in the world who feel like we must do penance and we're seeking redemption. I don't claim to understand the workings of the human mind, even though I inhabit one of them. It isn't puritanical in the sense that there's a God, a Protestant God, who's exacting this kind of penance. It seems to be something that is almost biologically preordained.
Yes. Yeah.
As if there were a biological or evolutionary advantage to this extreme masochism and submission in the female. It may exist in some men, but I think it's predominant in women, and there must be a biological or evolutionary advantage to it. But I did feel compassion for Ingrid. I just perhaps didn't make it that self-evident.
Well, it's sort of in this kind of book, one frequently feels, why is the writer, even if the world might do this to an Ingrid, or an Ingrid might do this to an Ingrid, why is the writer doing it? Here you don't ask. It doesn't seem like the writer, even though the punishments are laid on lavishly, it doesn't seem like a sadistic relation between the writer and the girl. Rather, it seems that the writer is suffering as silently as the victim.
Yes, I felt that. As I was saying, I identify with these girls from my childhood. I remember we lived next door to a family in which the father was quite abusive and alcoholic, and my best friend was a girl my own age, and she was quite mistreated. The whole family was quite mistreated, and it's a wonder the father didn't actually kill them, because he chased them with a butcher knife, and he was drunk and so forth. I felt such emotion for my girlfriend, but I also felt such relief that my father was not like that. And I think all these years I have felt a sense of guilt, an uneasy sense of privilege that I escaped that world, and I don't believe I was scarred by it. Also, my own parents had a very difficult lives. I really labor under the sense of unease and guilt, feeling that my life is very privileged. So again and again, I reenact in the fiction these scenes of almost ritualistic degradation in which I myself am demeaned or degraded. I thought you might mention the scene in which Ingrid is reading her poem, which is not her poem because she's afraid to read her own poem, and she picks at her face so that a trickle of blood runs down her forehead and her cheek in front of the whole audience, which seemed to me such a self-defiling, humiliating thing that, you know, you'd be feel that this is the worst possible thing that could happen in front of an audience and that you'd be mortified for life.
Well, especially since her mother, in one of the rare times that she has taken Ingrid in hand at that point of the book, promises to make her gorgeous.
And so this, that's right.
Yeah, that's the word. So that this blood is running through very thick makeup. Yes,
and ruining it.
Now, here, the book has a certain structural and imagistic set of symmetries. At the beginning of the book, Ingrid is hiding underneath a porch, and what she is watching for, essentially, is her missing father. She doesn't know when he's going to return. Although she's hiding from her mother, the yearned-for figure is the father. And that the father's disappearance seems to make way for the appearance of the Hell's Angel, Enoch Skaggs, who becomes a second father who also imprisons her in a basement, a cellar, a root-like, insect-filled, garbage-strewn place. And so it seems as if the father figure here is one of, however desired, is one of enormous punishment. And the mother, however misguided in her impulse to cover the face with a mask of makeup, is still nevertheless a more merciful.
Much more, and good-humored and kind of, you know, comic about it. Like at the end of the novel, she says, well, this is a beautiful, sunny, icy morning, like the first morning of creation, even if you have a hangover.
I've noticed, speaking of those first mornings of creation, that over the years there's developed a truly beautiful, if I suggest sometimes ironic, vision of American activities and holidays. At the end of We Were the Mulvaneys, there's an extraordinary softball game going on, and everything that could happen mercifully at this point for the Mulvaneys does. In fact, the missing son is pitching.
That's right. You don't recognize him at first because he's been living in California. And as we know, California is a place of redemption.
And change.
And your hair bleaches and your hair gets long and you get more masculine or more feminine or more androgynous. You know, something happens to you.
But suddenly, you know, one of the family is up at bat, another is on the base. You know, everyone is there, and they've all brought food, and the vegetables seem to be, as you say, works of art.
That's right. That's because the father's missing.
Is that it?
The father's missing. That
he's
malevolent.
Dead.
Well, the father's gone. You see, they had to regroup after the father dies, and he could have been part of that, but his will and his pride was such that he couldn't. Deal with his daughter being violated by a high school boy, basically. But it is like the regrouping of the family, but the father is absent. I so wanted to write a novel. In fact, the novel that I'm working on now, I wanted to write a novel about the redemption of the father, where the father's brought back, because I felt that I'd been very harsh on that masculine principle. And so I'm working on a way of somehow plausibly bringing a benevolent father back into a family situation.
Well, what I see here, and perhaps it's influenced by a recent reading of the Don DeLillo book, the title is
Underworld.
Underworld, thank goodness, in which two Bruegel paintings are dominant. But I notice a kind of Bruegel-like panoramic detail as of the child's games, almost as if in the long-distant panoramic view, American holidays can be what they're supposed to be. It's only in close-up, when you narrow in a Joyce Carol Oates, that the, well, what Ingrid tells us is that she looks pretty from a distance, but if you see her up close, you see the nicks at edges of her eyes and lips. And it seems to be the case that things viewed up close here cannot resist the eye that sees their mutilation.
Well, that may be true. What has struck me about Man Crazy, and this is something I don't often talk about because there isn't really the occasion, is how people have responded to it, which surprised me. I've met a number of people, including young women, who say that I've told their story. And I kind of cringe and flinch to think that that could be the case. I think what they mean is I've exaggerated their story. And they talk about how they, too, lost a father to divorce, how they, too, became involved in drugs and high school promiscuity and deep unhappiness and suicidal tendencies and eating disorders and picking at the skin. And all this constellation of adolescent maladies that some people feel very impatient with. But when you are an adolescent and you're a girl, somehow this is your whole universe. That experience of having your skin all itchy, I have had that experience, and I probably will again. And yet there must be people in the world who don't even know what it is, whose skin has never risen up against them. To have your skin break out in all sorts of hives and itchy rashes, as if the skin, which is an envelope to protect us, were attacking us. And, of course, Ingrid has this experience. This has very much to do with stress. But there may be some people who have never had that experience.
At the same time, it's almost as if, and it's one of the things that makes the book sort of homely and makes me think of a saint's life, this harrowing seems to be yearned for.
Yes. It's a way of purifying. We want to know that our punishment is just. Most of us feel that we may deserve the things that happen to us. I don't ever feel I deserve the good things that happen to me, but I always feel that I deserve the bad things. And I was wondering, in an objective way, whether other people are like that, and if so, what it means. And what step is there from saying, I want to know my punishment is just, to the next step being, I want to ensure that I have punishment. That seems to be a kind of transgression, that to step from one stage to the other would be really very dangerous, very perverse, to be seeking out punishment.
I've been speaking to Joyce Carol Oates. The most recent book is Man Crazy, published by Dutton. Thank you very much for joining me. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Additional program assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse, what kind?
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.